This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC-64995, Hugo Chavez, by Judith Levin. Copyright 2007 by InfoBase Publishing. Read by Mark Ashby. This book contains 123 pages on 3 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. This recording is tone indexed. The beginning of each item in the table of contents will be indicated by a beep audible when your cassette player is in fast forward or rewind. Library of Congress Annotation. Biography of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who was first elected in 1998 and labeled a negative force by the American government, highlights Chavez's use of his country's oil reserves and discusses his relationships with Fidel Castro, Saddam Hussein, and leaders in Iran. For junior and senior high readers. 2007. From the book jacket. Despite being elected by the largest majority of any president in Venezuela's 40-year history of democracy, Hugo Chavez has faced determined opposition from within Venezuela and also the United States. The supporters of his left-wing government see him as the first Venezuelan leader who truly represents the majority of people in this very poor country. The opposition believes he is dismantling the country's democratic institutions and becoming the latest in a long history of military dictators. Colorful and outspoken, the organizer of a 1992 attempted coup d'etat against the government, and the target of one in 2002, Chavez is one of the most polarizing figures in modern politics. Both passionately hated and steadfastly loved by Venezuelans, he is feared by the United States for his ties to Cuba's Fidel Castro, his socialist ideals, and his control of an important source of the world's oil. Whether he is a liberator of the people or a power-hungry agitator remains to be seen. But he is certain to attract controversy. Modern World Leaders offers absorbing accounts of the men and women whose ideas and actions are changing the course of history. With an emphasis on personal background, leadership qualities, and historical perspective, this series spotlights the leaders making headlines today. About the authors. Judith Levin is a writer living in New York City. She has published books for Rosen Publishing and Oxford University Press on subjects ranging from a biography of young adult author Christopher Paul Curtis to the history and excavation of the ancient Aztec city of Tenochtitlan. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. is the leading American historian of our time. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his books The Age of Jackson, 1945, and A Thousand Days, 1965, which also won the National Book Award. Professor Schlesinger is the Albert Schweitzer Professor of the Humanities at the City University of New York and has been involved in several other Chelsea House projects, including the series Revolutionary War Leaders, Colonial Leaders, and Your Government. All links and web addresses were checked and verified to be correct at the time of publication. Because of the dynamic nature of the web, some addresses and links may have changed since publication and may no longer be valid. Table of Contents. Forward. On Leadership. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. Side 1, Tone 2. 1. Hugo Chavez in the News. Side 1, Tone 3. 2. Hugo Chavez and Venezuelan History. Side 1, Tone 4. 3. After the Revolution. Side 1, Tone 5. 4. Enter Hugo Chavez. Side 1, Tone 6. 5. Toward a Revolution. Side 1, Tone 7. 6. The 1989 Riots and the 1992 Coup Attempt. Side 2, Tone 1. 7. The Election of Chavez. Side 2, Tone 2. 8. The 2002 Coup d'Etat Attempt. Side 2, Tone 3. 9. Missions and Oppositions. Side 2, Tone 4. 10. The Future of Hugo Chavez. Side 3, Tone 1. Chronology. Side 3, Tone 2. Bibliography. Side 3, Tone 3. Further Reading. Side 3, Tone 4. Reader's Note. The photo credits found in the print edition are not included in this recording. Captions to photographs and illustrations located throughout the book have been gathered at the end of the chapter or section in which they appear. End of reader's note. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., On Leadership. Leadership, it may be said, is really what makes the world go round. Love no doubt smooths the passage, but love is a private transaction between consenting adults. Leadership is a public transaction with history. The idea of leadership affirms the capacity of individuals to move, inspire, and mobilize masses of people so that they act together in pursuit of an end. Sometimes leadership serves good purposes, sometimes bad. But whether the end is benign or evil, great leaders are those men and women who leave their personal stamp on history. Now, the very concept of leadership implies the proposition that individuals can make a difference. This proposition has never been universally accepted. From classical times to the present day, eminent thinkers have regarded individuals as no more than the agents and pawns of larger forces, whether the gods and goddesses of the ancient world, or in the modern era, race, class, nation, the dialectic, the will of the people, the spirit of the times, history itself. Against such forces, the individual dwindles into insignificance. So contends the thesis of historical determinism. Tolstoy's great novel, War and Peace, offers a famous statement of the case. Why, Tolstoy asked, did millions of men in the Napoleonic Wars, denying their human feelings and their common sense, move back and forth across Europe slaughtering their fellows? The war, Tolstoy answered, was bound to happen simply because it was bound to happen. All prior history determined it. As for leaders, they, Tolstoy said, are but the labels that serve to give a name to an end, and, like labels, they have the least possible connection with the event. The greater the leader, the more conspicuous the inevitability and the predestination of every act he commits. The leader, said Tolstoy, is the slave of history. Determinism takes many forms. Marxism is the determinism of class, Nazism the determinism of race. But the idea of men and women as the slaves of history runs athwart the deepest human instincts. Rigid determinism abolishes the idea of human freedom, the assumption of free choice that underlies every move we make, every word we speak, every thought we think. It abolishes the idea of human responsibility, since it is manifestly unfair to reward or punish people for actions that are by definition beyond their control. No one can live consistently by any deterministic creed. The Marxist states prove this themselves by their extreme susceptibility to the cult of leadership. More than that, history refutes the idea that individuals make no difference. In December 1931, a British politician crossing Fifth Avenue in New York City between 76th and 77th Streets around 10:30 p.m. looked in the wrong direction and was knocked down by an automobile. A moment, he later recalled, of a man aghast, a world aglare. I do not understand why I was not broken like an eggshell or squashed like a gooseberry. 14 months later, an American politician, sitting in an open car in Miami, Florida, was fired on by an assassin. The man beside him was hit. Those who believe that individuals make no difference to history might well ponder whether the next 2 decades would have been the same had Mario Constantino's car killed Winston Churchill in 1931 and Giuseppe Zangara's bullet killed Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. Suppose, in addition, that Lenin had died of typhus in Siberia in 1895, and that Hitler had been killed on the Western Front in 1916. What would the 20th century have looked like now? For better or for worse, individuals do make a difference. The notion that a people can run itself and its affairs anonymously, wrote the philosopher William James, is now well known to be the silliest of absurdities. Mankind does nothing save through initiatives on the part of inventors, great or small, and imitation by the rest of us. These are the sole factors in human progress. Individuals of genius show the way and set the patterns, which common people then adopt and follow. Leadership, James suggests, means leadership in thought as well as in action. In the long run, leaders in thought may well make the greater difference to the world. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, wrote John Maynard Keynes, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men, who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences, are usually the slaves of some defunct economist, The power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. But, as Woodrow Wilson once said, those only are leaders of men, in the general eye, who lead in action. It is at their hands that new thought gets its translation into the crude language of deeds. Leaders in thought often invent in solitude and obscurity, leaving to later generations the tasks of imitation. Leaders in action, the leaders portrayed in this series, have to be effective in their own time. And they cannot be effective by themselves. They must act in response to the rhythms of their age. Their genius must be adapted, in a phrase from William James, to the receptivities of the moment. Leaders are useless without followers. "There goes the mob," said the French politician, hearing a clamor in the streets. "I am their leader. I must follow them." Great leaders turn the inchoate emotions of the mob to purposes of their own. They seize on the opportunities of their time, the hopes, fears, frustrations, crises, potentialities. They succeed when events have prepared the way for them, when the community is awaiting to be aroused, when they can provide the clarifying and organizing ideas. Leadership completes the circuit between the individual and the mass, and thereby alters history. It may alter history for better or for worse. Leaders have been responsible for the most extravagant follies and most monstrous crimes that have beset suffering humanity. They have also been vital in such gains as humanity has made in individual freedom, religious and racial tolerance, social justice, and respect for human rights. There is no sure way to tell in advance who is going to lead for good and who for evil. But a glance at the gallery of men and women in modern world leaders suggests some useful tests. One test is this: do leaders lead by force or by persuasion, by command or by consent? Through most of history, leadership was exercised by the divine right of authority. The duty of followers was to defer and to obey. Theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. On occasion, as with the so-called enlightened despots of the 18th century in Europe, absolutist leadership was animated by humane purposes. More often, absolutism nourished the passion for domination, land, gold, and conquest, and resulted in tyranny. The great revolution of modern times has been the revolution of equality. "Perhaps no form of government," wrote the British historian James Bryce in his study of the United States, the American Commonwealth, "needs great leaders so much as democracy." The idea that all people should be equal in their legal condition has undermined the old structure of authority, hierarchy, and deference. The revolution of equality has had two contrary effects on the nature of leadership. For equality, as Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out in his great study Democracy in America, might mean equality in servitude as well as equality in freedom. "I know of only two methods of establishing equality in the political world," Tocqueville wrote. "Rights must be given to every citizen, or none at all to anyone, save one, who is the master of all. There was no middle ground between the sovereignty of all and the absolute power of one man." In his astonishing prediction of 20th century totalitarian dictatorship, Tocqueville explained how the revolution of equality could lead to the Führerprinzip and more terrible absolutism than the world had ever known. But when rights are given to every citizen and the sovereignty of all is established, the problem of leadership takes a new form, becomes more exacting than ever before. It is easy to issue commands and enforce them by the rope and the stake, the concentration camp and the gulag. It is much harder to use argument and achievement to overcome opposition and win consent. The founding fathers of the United States understood the difficulty. They believed that history had given them the opportunity to decide, as Alexander Hamilton wrote in the First Federalist Paper, whether men are indeed capable of basing government on reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend on accident and force. Government by reflection and choice called for a new style of leadership and a new quality of followership. It required leaders to be responsive to popular concerns, and it required followers to be active and informed participants in the process. Democracy does not eliminate emotion from politics. Sometimes it fosters demagoguery, but it is confident that, as the greatest of democratic leaders put it, you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. It measures leadership by results and retires those who overreach or falter or fail. It is true that in the long run, despots are measured by results too. But they can postpone the day of judgment, sometimes indefinitely, and in the meantime they can do infinite harm. It is also true that democracy is no guarantee of virtue and intelligence in government, for the voice of the people is not necessarily the voice of God. But democracy, by assuring the right of opposition, offers built-in resistance to the evils inherent in absolutism. As the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr summed it up, man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to justice makes democracy necessary. A second test for leadership is the end for which power is sought. When leaders have as their goal the supremacy of a master race, or the promotion of totalitarian revolution, or the acquisition and exploitation of colonies, or the protection of greed and privilege, or the preservation of personal power, it is likely that their leadership will do little to advance the cause of humanity. When their goal is the abolition of slavery, the liberation of women, the enlargement of opportunity for the poor and powerless, the extension of equal rights to racial minorities, the defense of the freedoms of expression and opposition, it is likely that their leadership will increase the sum of human liberty and welfare. Leaders have done great harm to the world. They have also conferred great benefits. You will find both sorts in this series. Even good leaders must be regarded with a certain wariness. Leaders are not demigods. They put on their trousers one leg after another just like ordinary mortals. No leader is infallible, and every leader needs to be reminded of this at regular intervals. Irreverence irritates leaders, but is their salvation. Unquestioning submission corrupts leaders and demeans followers. Making a cult of a leader is always a mistake. Fortunately, hero worship generates its own antidote. Every hero, said Emerson, becomes a bore at last. The single benefit the great leaders confer is to embolden the rest of us to live according to our own best selves, to be active, insistent, and resolute in affirming our own sense of things. For great leaders attest to the reality of human freedom against the supposed inevitabilities of history. And they attest to the wisdom and power that may lie within the most unlikely of us, which is why Abraham Lincoln remains the supreme example of great leadership. A great leader, said Emerson, exhibits new possibilities to all humanity. We feed on genius. Great men exist that there may be greater men. Great leaders, in short, justify themselves by emancipating and empowering their followers. So humanity struggles to master its destiny, remembering with Alexis de Tocqueville, it is true that around every man a fatal circle is traced beyond which he cannot pass, but within the wide verge of that circle he is powerful and free. As it is with man, so with communities. Chapter 1. Hugo Chavez in the News. Since his election to Venezuela's presidency in 1998, Hugo Chavez has claimed that the United States plans to assassinate him or to invade Venezuela or both. In August of 2005, Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson indeed called for President Chavez's assassination. Robertson said of Chavez, "He has destroyed the Venezuelan economy, and he's going to make that a launching pad for communist infiltration and Muslim extremism all over the continent of South America. If he thinks we're going to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war, and I don't think any oil shipments will stop." The U.S. response to this was mixed. In an editorial cartoon, Ed Stein depicted two Muslim men witnessing Pat Robertson's televised call for Chavez's death. One of them says to the other, "Christianity is a religion of peace, but it gets perverted by fundamentalist religious extremists." The Chicago Tribune commented that Robertson was being wacky. U.S. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick said Robertson's remark had been inappropriate. In a New York Daily News editorial headed, "Rev's Call to Kill Shames Us All," Errol Lewis said, rather more forcefully, that wacky and inappropriate are words to use when your uncle says silly things at the dinner table, not when the man who founded Christian Broadcasting in the United States and who has ties to the White House calls for the assassination of the democratically elected leader of another country. When a Muslim leader calls for President Bush's death, Lewis pointed out, we call that terrorism, not wacky. But officials from the administration of President George W. Bush said only that assassination is not part of United States government policy. Criticized by numerous U.S. religious leaders, Robertson apologized. It is not right, he agreed, to call for an assassination. But was he sorry? He didn't seem to be, actually. In his apology, he cited Protestant theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who supported efforts in Nazi Germany to assassinate Adolf Hitler and was put to death for his involvement in that assassination attempt. Robertson and many others indeed see Chavez as a serious threat to the United States, calling him a dictator who intends to fund the violent overthrow of democratically elected governments throughout South America. President Chavez's own response to Robertson was only in part predictable. Chavez was, with some justice, able to say, "I told you they want to assassinate me." He noted that the official response to Robertson's terrorist remarks was tepid. A few weeks later, he said this with considerable force when he told an American interviewer, "If the imperialist government of the White House dares to invade Venezuela, the war of 100 years will be unleashed in South America." But just days after Robertson's remarks, Chavez offered to sell low-cost gasoline and heating oil to poor communities in the United States, including to Native American tribal communities. Robert Free Galvan, who spoke to Indian tribes concerning Chavez's offer, says that Chavez and others in Latin America seek an alternative to the World Trade Organization, WTO, North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and other economic organizations that seem to favor the rich and powerful corporations. Chavez has spent billions of oil dollars on education, feeding, and housing the people of his country. Previous governments, Galvan continued, had channeled much of the country's resources into a few hands. Chavez, himself part indigenous and part black, born into a poor rural family that had not benefited from Venezuela's years of prosperity, wanted that to change. A few weeks later, after Hurricane Katrina caused billions of dollars of damage to the coasts of Louisiana and Mississippi, Chavez became the first foreign leader to offer a massive aid package to the United States Gulf Coast. President Chavez said Venezuela would immediately send food, water, and 1 million extra barrels of petroleum, 66,000 at reduced rates for poor communities affected by the storm, to its North American brothers. Additionally, he offered mobile hospital units, medical personnel, and power generators, all of them badly needed by the people of that region. The Bush administration said no. The aid was, in fact, provided anyway, through the oil company Citgo, which is owned by Venezuela. One key word that comes up repeatedly in discussions of President Chavez and his policies, and in the U.S. response to Chavez, is oil. Venezuela's identity as the world's fifth largest producer of oil is critical to our understanding of the role of the country and its leader in modern politics. After Chavez took office, he traveled around the world to meet with the other members of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. He became the first world leader to visit Saddam Hussein since the 1991 Gulf War. It was one of many visits made in order to reconstitute OPEC and curtail the production of oil, raising the price of oil per barrel. Oil prices had, in the 1980s, been driven down when OPEC's control over production had faltered and the oil market was glutted. With the world supply of oil way up, its price dropped. This drop in price had been disastrous for Venezuela. 90% of foreign exports and 75% of the government's income are based on oil money, and when the price of oil fell, Venezuela found itself unable to pay off its foreign debt. Its unit of currency, the bolivar, fell in value against foreign currencies by almost 90% between 1983 and 1988. In Venezuela, prices went up, unemployment rose, and such staples as salt, rice, and sugar were in short supply. Eventually, the banks failed. Chavez's success in urging OPEC to regulate oil production has increased the country's income to the point that it can fund his numerous programs, called missions for the poor, providing schools, medical care, and other essentials. But the government of the United States, among others, doesn't like Chavez's friends. Not only did Chavez visit Iran and Iraq, he has also allied himself with Cuba's Fidel Castro and angered U.S. leaders by undermining the U.S. embargo on Cuban products. He is accused of harboring guerrilla fighters from neighboring Colombia and refuses the United States' request to use Venezuela's airspace in its war against drugs in Colombia. Some American critics go further, accusing Chavez of funding or even training Middle East terrorists. All in all, relations between the United States and the current government of Venezuela could scarcely be worse. The United States has labeled Chavez a negative force in the region and fears his efforts to unite Latin American countries, a charge that has never been proved. When the shortest coup d'etat, forceful takeover of a government, in history, removed Chavez from office for 2 days in 2002, the United States was quick to recognize the government that replaced him and has been accused by Chavez of aiding and abetting that coup. Nearly every other government in the Western Hemisphere condemned the coup. If the U.S. government has not attempted to assassinate him, as Chavez claims, then it has at the least contributed $5 million to his opponents through National Endowment for Democracy, an organization funded through the U.S. Congress, in an effort to bring down his government. Yet Mr. Chavez was elected by a majority of 56.2%, the largest margin in Venezuela's history, in a democratic vote that was verified as accurate and honest by the Carter Center, managed at that time by former President Jimmy Carter. Chavez, for his part, calls President Bush Mr. Danger. Venezuelan television has broadcast recordings of U.S. criticisms of Chavez, accompanied by the Evil Empire music from Star Wars. Chavez has likened capitalism to Frankenstein's monster, Count Dracula, Jack the Ripper, and the Boston Strangler. He adds that capitalists are worse. And in 2004, Chavez warned Washington that if the United States attempted to kill him or to invade, he would indeed cut off oil shipments. In 2006, he again threatened to cease selling oil to the United States. It may be one of the times when a nation can in fact be said to have another over a barrel, in this case, many millions of barrels, all of them filled with oil. So who is this man who provokes assassination requests from a right-wing Christian leader and who seems to respond with the Christian virtue of turning the other cheek, offering aid to the poor or hurricane-struck of the United States and calling them brothers? He is, for one thing, a man about whom it seems impossible to be neutral. Some people see him as an idealist, a socialist leader who will at long last free Venezuela's poor from a history of abuse and disempowerment that is as old as Spain's conquest of the land in the 15th century. His supporters point to his democratic election and his many social programs for the poor. They believe his personal history as the child of a poor rural family makes him able to genuinely represent his people. Others see him as a man who is on his way to becoming the latest in a long history of Venezuelan military dictators, citing human rights violations, changes in the Constitution that increase his power, and his laws that make it illegal to criticize him or his policies. Some people claim that he is actually insane. In Venezuela, of course, the debates over Chavez's true identity, Hugo the Messiah, or Hurricane Hugo, and his intentions are hotter than those in the United States. Before being elected in 1998, Chavez, a member of the Venezuelan military, had been jailed for leading a failed 1992 coup against then-President Carlos Andrés Pérez. He himself was the subject of that very short coup in 2002, as well as strikes and work stoppages. He is, the New York Times pointed out in 2002, a leader so controversial that construction workers and upper-class housewives in designer dresses have at times united against him. But it is the poor who elected Chavez and the poor who keep him in office, who supported his constitutional changes and voted no in the 2004 recall referendum that would have peacefully removed him from office. Venezuela is a country with an underclass so vast, about 80% of the country's 25 million people, that they can outvote the unions and the upper class. In Chavez, they see the hope for a kind of social change. Chavez himself would say a revolution that has never happened in Venezuela. He is not only from a poor background, he is mestizo, mixed race, like most of Venezuela's citizens. Now, poor Venezuelans look in the mirror and see a future president. That is what makes the elite feel threatened, a hardware store clerk said to the New York Times magazine. That the debate is heated reflects the importance of what is at stake. Venezuela was a colony of Spain for 300 years, and most of the time, a military dictatorship after that. Democracy in Venezuela isn't very old, only about 40 years. Chavez was democratically elected, but he has used the military to run many of his social programs and gives the military a role far larger than his predecessors. Venezuelans fear violence. The riots of 1989, although they took place before Chavez's presidency, as well as the attempted coups and other violent protests, are reminders of how volatile their country can be. What's more, a military dictatorship would seem to many Venezuelans to be old-fashioned. Revolutions and coup d'etats are so yesterday, said a young dentist who was educated in the United States in a New York Times Magazine article. It's really embarrassing for Venezuela. Embarrassment aside, some Venezuelans fear Chavez's effect on the economy. Chavez has helped pass laws that allow the government to expropriate, take over, some of the land belonging to some of Venezuela's rich families and give it to the poor, arguing that it is wrong for the country to be importing more than 60% of its food while land lies fallow and farmers have no place to farm. He has taken over idle factories and turned them over to the workers to run. But such programs threaten the people who own and run big businesses in Venezuela and make them, as well as foreign investors, reluctant to invest their money there. Even before Chavez was elected, many of Venezuela's richer people took themselves and their money out of the country. That the debate is heated reflects the importance of the issues, but that it is also colorful reflects the identity of the president himself, whose media presence is unsurpassed. Friends and foes agree that he is a natural showman. Having surrendered after leading the failed coup of 1992, Chavez was allowed 90 seconds on television in order to tell his co-conspirators to lay down their weapons. It didn't take him the whole 90 seconds to capture the country's attention. In well under a minute, Chavez managed to rally support for his cause, saying that, por ahora, for the moment, the coup had failed, thus suggesting that the next time it wouldn't. He became, with that one speech, a hero. Then, in 2002, appearing on television after the coup that failed to topple him, he told the cameras to back up so that viewers could see the portraits flanking him, Jesus on his right, and on his left, Simon Bolivar, his hero, the 19th-century liberator of several South American countries from Spain. Since his election, Chavez has appeared on his own highly rated TV show, Alo Presidente, Hello President, on Sundays. He dresses casually, sometimes appearing in jeans and a bright red shirt. The show is unscripted. It starts at about 11 in the morning and ends whenever the president is done talking and taking calls, and sometimes playing video footage of himself traveling the country, visiting hospitals, schools, or ordinary people at work. At least once, that was 8 hours later, long after his live audience, who are not permitted to leave, had given up hoping for a toilet break or a meal. On the show, the president talks about personal memories, sings or recites poetry, and discusses politics, Christianity, and his first love, baseball. On one notable show, several of these subjects came together, as Chavez fired 7 of the upper managers of the state-run oil company by hollering, "You're out," and blowing an umpire's whistle. He also keeps audiences informed about how his youngest daughter's pet turtle is doing. Alo Presidente is watched intently by Chavez's followers, and also by his opponents, who seem to have a horrified fascination with it. He sings, he rambles, he speaks in sentence fragments, and, say those who disagree with him, the content of what he says seems to run out your ears or through your fingers, too liquid to argue with or even to identify. A competing show, Alo Ciudadanos, Hello Citizens, does attempt to respond critically to Chavez's statements, but, says the station's owner, Alberto Revel, it is like keeping up with the Energizer Bunny. It is not possible to know what the long-term outcome of Hugo Chavez's presidency will be, but it is possible to look at his history and the history of his country and understand how Venezuela produced a leader like Chavez. Captions to photographs. 1. Polarizing television evangelist Pat Robertson called for the assassination of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez during the August 22, 2005 broadcast of his show The 700 Club. Robertson asserted that it is the duty of the United States to stop Chavez from making Venezuela a launching pad for communist infiltration and Muslim extremism. 2. Hugo Chavez talks with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, Iraq, on August 10, 2000. The Venezuelan president has been sympathetic to Iraq and its former leader, to the chagrin of the United States and its allies. 3. After attempting to overthrow Venezuela's government, Hugo Chavez, then a lieutenant colonel, was arrested and escorted by military intelligence officers on February 5, 1992. End of captions. Chapter 2. Hugo Chavez and Venezuelan History. Hugo Chavez's election and his role in modern Venezuela cannot be understood without knowing a little of Venezuela's history. President Chavez often refers to his country's history, such as when the new constitution he helped pass renamed the country the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and when he says his policies are part of a Bolivarian revolution. Bolivarian is a reference to Simón Bolívar, an important leader of the 19th century fight to free Venezuela and many other Latin American countries from Spanish rule. The roots of modern Venezuelan politics go back as far as Spain's conquest of what is now Venezuela in the 1400s, when, on August 8, 1498, 4 men from a tribe called the Caribs discovered Christopher Columbus, then on his third voyage to what Europeans would call the New World. Columbus called it Tierra de Gracia, Land of Graces, because it was so beautiful. The Carib men no doubt had some of the same response to Europeans as many native peoples. They found the Europeans pale and hairy, and possessed of such oddities as pants, guns, and horses. Chavez once joked with a female interviewer who asked him about his hairless legs. He said they are hairless because of the Indians in his mixed racial heritage. The initial Spanish conquest of Central and South America was made in search of riches. Even after explorers realized that they had failed to find a western route to the spices of India and the wealth that would have brought, they were looking for wealth rather than for a place to settle. The conquistadors, conquerors, wanted money and believed they would find gold in the New World. They found some, and gold is still one of Venezuela's exports, but they never found the great wealth they sought. They could not find it, because what they were looking for didn't exist. They sought a legend, El Dorado, a kingdom where gold was so plentiful that the king wore gold dust rubbed into his body. The Spanish conquest was a disaster for the many native peoples. The Spanish took what gold they could find, sometimes by violence, and forced the natives to dive for pearls off the island of Cubagua until the pearls ran out, carried some natives away, and shipped others off as slaves. Native people died in wars, of overwork, or of European diseases, especially smallpox, for which they had no inherited immunity. Smallpox killed many people of European extraction as well, but it was nearly always fatal to native tribal peoples. One estimate is that the native population of South America was reduced by about 90% by the end of the conquest. Yet Spanish colonization differed from English colonization in one way that is crucial. Whereas the English seemed to have seen native peoples largely as an impediment to colonization and wished to remove them, the Spanish viewed them as a kind of natural resource and wished to keep them around and put them to work. It was partly a matter of attitudes towards physical work. Many people who write about the Spanish conquest note that the Spaniards who settled the South American colonies believed that labor was menial and degrading, and to this day, a middle-class Venezuelan man prefers not to have to shine his own shoes. By the middle of the 1500s, the Spanish had decided that the real riches of the New World lay in its fertile lands. They established haciendas, or plantations, for the exotic and valuable products they learned about from the New World's native inhabitants. Many of the products we take for granted come, of course, from the Americas, including chocolate, potatoes, tomatoes, and corn. Tobacco, coffee, and sugarcane from Asia also would be grown in huge amounts in the New World. In the 1500s, the most important of these would be something Europeans had never seen before, cacao, chocolate, from a tree they, very scientifically, named in Latin, Theobroma cacao, food of the gods. Chocolate, in the form of hot chocolate, became, like coffee and tea, one of the high-class luxury foods of Europeans. The encomienda system that bound the natives to Spanish settlers as laborers on plantations said that the natives had to work as slaves for the Spanish, but that the hacienda's owners had to take care of them. In practice, this meant that the owners forced Christianity on native people, but did not take care of them. Many died, though some escaped and ran away to the Llanos, the vast plains of central Venezuela. Beginning in the early 1500s, enslaved blacks from Africa were brought over both for the mining of gold and copper and to work on cacao plantations. By the mid-1600s, the most valuable Spanish exports were cacao, tobacco, wheat, and animal hides from the herds of cattle on the Llanos. The cattle had been a European import. At the time of the conquest, there were no horses or cattle native to the Americas. The Spanish also exported native people to the island of Hispaniola, now the Dominican Republic and Haiti, to work as slaves on the sugar plantations there. The most profitable export remained cacao, and the wealthiest people in Venezuela were the plantation owners in the fertile region that the Spanish called Caracas, now the country's capital and biggest city. They farmed mostly the one crop, and it was better than gold. Chocolate prices boomed. The rich plantation owners were variously called mantuanos, for the expensive clothes from Mantua, Spain, that the women wore, or as a class, gran cacao, for the source of their wealth. Racially, they were called blancos, or whites. The German Alexander von Humboldt said of them, "In no other part of Spanish America has civilization assumed a more European character. They seemed," he said, "more European than Europeans." Many people were criollas, or creoles, people of Spanish heritage born in the New World. Although many criollas were wealthy, they were always likely to find themselves passed over for political appointments from Spain. These went to peninsulares, Spaniards born in Spain, Lower in the social and financial hierarchy were the enslaved blacks. There were also a number of runaway blacks and Indians. Some of them went to the Llanos region and became cowboys, herding cattle. It was a recognizable cowboy culture, with the hard work of herding cattle and the toughness and independence that goes along with that way of life. Except when it was rainy season and they had to herd cattle from canoes, which is not what North Americans expect of cowboys. The majority of the population was mixed race, in part because few Spanish women settled in the New World. The offspring of Spaniards and natives were called mestizos. There were also zambos, of Indian and black parentage, and mulattoes, of black and white parentage, all of whom are sometimes called pardos, or browns. Some estimates say that the population of Venezuela in 1700 was 45% pardo, 25% white, 15% Indian, and 15% black. In practice, it was probably even more mixed than that, since it is often impossible to know people's racial background by looking at them. This fact troubled the upper-class whites, who made laws that pardos had to wear different clothes than whites and couldn't study at the university. A popular motto said, "Todo blanco es caballero," every white man is a gentleman. Pardos worked in trades, as laborers, or on cattle ranches. There was thus an established, legalized separation of people that largely corresponded with both race and class. All this would be important when it came to Venezuela's wars of independence from Spain. In 1728, the Bourbon family of Spain, then in power, reorganized the colonial governmental and economic structure to make it more efficient and more profitable. Plantation owners had been defying Spain and trading with smugglers to avoid Spanish taxes. The Bourbons gave the Compañía Guipuzcoana, also known as the Caracas Company, a monopoly on cacao, which then gave them the power to set the price that would be paid to farmers for cacao, since there was no one else the farmers could sell it to. Venezuela came to its revolution in a time of revolutions, those of the 13 colonies, that would become the United States, of France, and of Haiti. And Venezuela revolted for reasons related to all of these. Its revolution was, in some ways, like that of the 13 colonies, who wanted free trade and were impatient with overseas rulers that saw them as a cash cow. The French Revolution had less to do with trade and was more an uprising against an aristocracy. Haiti's revolution was a rebellion against slavery. Venezuela's revolutionaries were influenced by all of these. The different populations and the different agendas would make for a messy revolution, and ultimately a messy post-revolutionary period. The black and brown majority, for instance, had no reason to believe they would be better off under local rule than under overseas rule by Spain. Although there had been revolts against slaveholders, the first protest by whites against Spain was in 1749 by a Creole who lost his job to a peninsular. He was sent to prison. Black rebels of the same period were put to death. A number of early uprisings and independence movements were put down easily. Venezuelan-born Francisco Miranda, for example, was inspired by the revolutionary spirit he had seen while living in France and America. He brought a force of Americans, English, French, and Irish volunteers to free his native country, then was startled to discover that the Venezuelan response was not to join the revolution, but to call for Spanish soldiers to get rid of them. What set off the Venezuelan independence movement with some seriousness was a change in administration in Spain. Venezuelans woke up one morning in 1810 to discover that they were a French colony instead of a Spanish one. Napoleon Bonaparte had defeated and imprisoned King Fernando VII of Spain, and Napoleon's brother Joseph was now their king. King Joseph sent replacement governments to all the Spanish colonies of the New World. None of the Spanish colonies were happy about this, but Venezuela's economic dependence on a single crop made it particularly vulnerable to the change in regime. If Venezuela became a French colony, then it would be, like France, at war with England. This was a problem because the English were Venezuela's best customers. So, although there had been small rebellions, it can be said that the real independence movement began in Caracas with a group of angry plantation owners who did not want their trade with England disrupted. They were a small percentage of the population, so almost from the beginning, they had to consider what they would need to do to gain the support of the rest of the country. Very early in the movement, for instance, they called for an end to the slave trade, though not the freeing of the slaves, in an effort simultaneously to appease the pardos, but not lose their workers. The 1811 independence movement created a very short-lived First Republic of Venezuela. It also produced a civil war with those people who were loyal to Spain. The Loyalists said that the March 12, 1812 earthquake in Caracas was proof that God was angry at the rebels. The Loyalists and a Spanish army of 230 men defeated Francisco Miranda, who had tried for independence in 1806, and a 28-year-old named Simón Bolívar. Miranda would die in a Spanish prison. Bolívar was allowed to go into exile. The Venezuelan independence movement was the first in Latin America, but not by long. In New Granada, now Colombia, Bolívar was able to raise an army of 70 men. Collecting troops as they traveled, the army retook Caracas. It was during this 1813 campaign that Bolívar was given the title Liberator, by which he is still known in many countries of Latin America he helped to free. Bolívar created and commanded Venezuela's second republic, its second government. This one wouldn't last long either. In 1814, Llanero's troops, Indians, Pardos, and slaves, led by José Tomás Boves, fought against Bolívar and his troops. Boves had been turned down for a command post by the revolutionaries, possibly because he was perceived as too rough and low class for them. He was white, but not a gentleman. Promising freedom to the slaves, he gathered a mixed-race force. Although there were blacks, whites, Indians, and mixed-race people on both sides of the war, Boves addressed, but also exploited, the racial tensions of the country. He brought a different kind of anger to the war, encouraging his troops to do as the Spanish general Monteverde had the year before, destroy farms and houses, loot, rape, and pillage. In Spain, the royalists had finally expelled Napoleon's army, and Fernando VII was back in power. In 1815, he sent 10,000 troops under the command of General Pablo Morillo to Venezuela. This should have been a crushing force, except that he found himself fighting Boves's Llanero's forces. Boves himself had died in battle, but when his troops tried to join up with Morillo, he told them he had no use for them, thus repeating the error that the revolutionaries had made with Boves himself. As a result, they fought against him instead of with him, using tactics that Morillo knew from the Spanish resistance to Napoleon. The Llanero's troops did not march in formation, but rather fought with guerrilla, literally small war, methods, setting ambushes and fighting in small groups with whatever weapons they could get. One new leader of the Llaneros was named Manuel Piar, a mulatto man. As historian Jeffrey Fox has said, the black, mulatto, and Indian soldiers in the Liberation Armies had a different stake in the war than the whites. For them, it was not enough to replace Spanish rulers with Mantuanos. They demanded a more open society, and symbolic of that openness would be the abolition of slavery. We might argue that the demand for the abolition of slavery was more than a symbol. Bolívar, while denying that racial differences had caused the domestic strife in America, meaning his America, visited Haiti, where enslaved blacks had risen up and defeated Napoleon's armies. Haiti's president, Alexandre Péan, gave Bolívar weapons and ships, with Bolívar agreeing that he would free Venezuela's slaves. In 1819, Bolívar established Venezuela's Third Republic, although the fighting would continue. The final battle was the defeat of the Spanish by Bolívar, Santiago Marino, and José Antonio Páez at Carabobo, near Valencia. Venezuela's independence had been accomplished by people of different races and countries fighting for different reasons. The last royalist troops would not be expelled until 1823 by Páez. Bolívar would go on to fight for the freedom of other South American countries and unite them very briefly into Gran Colombia, Greater Colombia, which included Venezuela, New Granada, Colombia, Panama, then a part of New Granada, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and part of Chile. He was also briefly the president of Gran Colombia and the dictator of Peru. Bolívar hoped to unite countries from Mexico to Argentina, but his vision of a united South America failed. Bolívar traveled great distances trying to preserve the unity of Gran Colombia, but Venezuela was the first country to secede from Gran Colombia under the leadership of José Antonio Páez. Bolívar, who would eventually be again called Liberator, whose statue would be erected in town squares and his picture put on people's walls like that of a saint, found himself demonized and the target of assassination attempts by ex-allies. In 1830, he resigned as president of Gran Colombia and dictator of Peru, and went into exile. He died later that year, having declared, "South America is ungovernable. Those in service of the revolution have plowed the seas." Venezuelan crowds proclaimed, "The tyrant is dead." Jeffrey Fox says poignantly, "He had destroyed the world he knew by destroying the colonial system, and he could not understand or accept the new world he had helped create." Captions to illustrations. 1. Philip V of Spain was the first Bourbon ruler of that country. The House of Bourbon ruled France, Spain, and Italy from as far back as the 16th century. 2. King Joseph Bonaparte, 1768-1844, ruled as the King of Naples from 1806-1808, and the King of Spain from 1808-1813. He was appointed by his brother, French Emperor Napoleon I. 3. South American revolutionary leader Simón Bolívar, 1783-1830, is the subject of this 19th century painting. Bolívar led the fight for independence in Venezuela and is celebrated as a hero there. End of captions. Chapter 3. After the Revolution. The revolution had gone on for 20 years and had left Venezuela in chaos. There had been little schooling. Crops and industries had been destroyed. For a generation, there had been only war. There had been no stable government. General José Antonio Páez formed a government, Venezuela's Fourth Republic, in 1830. It went against everything that Bolívar had fought for and believed in, and against everything the mestizos and pardos had fought for. Páez ruled as the first of Venezuela's Caudillo dictators. The term is often translated as strongman, but it also means something like war chief. By the end of the war, in the absence of a central government, Venezuela was ruled by local Caudillos, and there was no legal mechanism to create the sort of government that Bolívar and others had fought for. The people of Venezuela had no experience with a government of their own or a government they could trust. Páez had been a Caudillo before he was a general. He would now be the country's Caudillo, strong enough, he had been called the Tiger of the Llanos during the war, and, as ruler, rich enough to keep the lesser Caudillos at least somewhat in line. The tradition of Caudillo rulers is one that would flourish over the next century and a half, and it is the tradition that fuels the fears of Chávez's opponents, who see in him a hearkening back to that mode of rule. So a war that had been fought, at least by some, in the hopes of changing the social order, resulted in the 17-year rule, 1830-1847, of a military dictator and the reestablishment of a rich, white, increasingly urban elite in the Caracas region. It seemed all that had changed was that their wealth now came from coffee instead of cacao. The cacao plantations had been destroyed in the fighting, and coffee would be a more immediately profitable crop, requiring only about 5 years instead of cacao's 8 or 10 to be fruitful. Also, coffee had become more profitable than cacao, so the dependence on one crop would be replaced by the dependence on another. And again, it would be more profitable for most people to work on coffee plantations than to work their own small farms, so it was a system that somewhat discouraged people from owning and maintaining small independent farms. Páez, or people virtually appointed by Páez, would rule until 1847. They were, as a group, called the Conservative Oligarchy. They stood for a strong central government and supported the old privileges of the church and of the upper class. Then, in the 1840s, coffee prices fell worldwide. Many wealthy planters found themselves with debts they couldn't pay. An opposition to Páez formed that, in part, consisted of planters who wanted him to create policies that would help them not lose everything. The liberal opposition believed in voting rights for all men, the separation of church and state, and a somewhat decentralized government, with states and provinces having more power than the conservatives allowed them. But opposition leader Antonio Leocadio Guzmán also appealed to some of the llaneros, including the man who would be, along with Bolívar and Bolívar's teacher, Simón Rodríguez, one of Hugo Chávez's heroes, Ezequiel Zamora. He called himself the general of the sovereign people. His slogans were land and free men, general elections, and hatred toward the oligarchy. He sometimes used the cry of the French revolutionaries, liberty, equality, and fraternity. One of his actions was to order the burning of the building in Barinas, in which land titles were stored, so that when the poor seized land, as he wanted them to, there would be no records to help the landowners get it back. That was Zamora at his most extreme. But additionally, he believed in policies that would have dramatically, but less drastically, helped the very poor people of the Venezuelan countryside. He wanted a certain amount of land around each town to be available for common use, like the commons of Old English or American towns, where everyone could allow their animals to graze, and like the land allotted for many years to English peasants, on which they could raise the food they needed to survive. and he wanted large landowners to provide 10 milking cows to be grazed on common land to provide milk for the poor, many of whom couldn't have afforded cows even with free grazing. Exiled after a number of military defeats, Zamora returned to Venezuela in February of 1859 and fought until he was assassinated 10 months later. Hugo Chavez admires Zamora's goals, seeing him as someone who continued the fight for Bolivar's goals, including an end to slavery, which was ended in 1854, largely out of fear of slave uprisings, and Latin American unity. Baez's dictatorship had been harsh, yet it had also been stable. What followed was not stable at all. Zamora's rebellions were just some of the wars and rebellions that tore Venezuela apart for the rest of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. Although the failure of some plantations moved money into the hands of bankers and merchants, power remained in the hands of a relatively small percentage of the population, and there was never a break for long in the line of military dictators. The governments changed often, but one that lasted was that of Guzman Blanco, 1870 to 1888. He was accepted as a genuine aristocrat on the grounds that his feet were so small that he could wear his wife's slippers. Bolivar, too, had been admired for his tiny feet. The relative stability of his regime was based largely on the era. The world market was strong, so coffee, cattle, and cacao prices were high, and foreign investors had money to invest in such things as Venezuelan railroads. He built boulevards in Caracas like those he admired in Paris, where he spent a great deal of time and a great deal of money, most of it stolen from the Venezuelan people. He had sewers and electricity installed in Caracas, a water supply piped in, and a public transportation system created. Guzman Blanco became a rich, rich man, yet because times were good economically, he was able to stay in power until 1888. Later caudillos would have a harder time maintaining their power, mostly because coffee prices fell again. It was not until 1908 that Venezuela would again have a stable government, and that was under Juan Vicente Gómez, vice president to his predecessor, a barely literate dictator who took over the country in a military coup and ruled for 27 years, from 1908 to 1935. He is infamous in Venezuelan history for his corruption and greed, for seizing any land he wanted and any women. He never married, but is believed to have fathered more than 100 children. Some of the land seized may have been that of Hugo Chavez's great-grandfather, Pedro Pérez Delgado, nicknamed Mai Santa, who led an uprising against Vicente Gómez that failed to unseat the dictator. As president, Chavez expropriated the land, an estate called La Marquesena in Barinas. It remains unclear if his ancestor owned it or worked on it. Since Chavez believes that workers should own the land they farm or the factories they work in, it may not be a distinction that is important to him. Reading any historical discussion of Vicente Gómez's rule is a useful, confusing, revealing, and alarming exercise in understanding Venezuela's history. Gómez was, by any measure, a tyrant, a monster. People danced in the street when he died, peacefully, in his bed at age 78. He stole, raped, and tortured Venezuela's citizens at will. Some of those tortured were 17- and 18-year-old students who, in 1928, began a strike against him that led to a failed military revolt against the government. After his death, 14 tons of shackles used on prisoners were thrown into the sea. But, say historians, with wonder, he did at least manage to create and maintain a stable government. That continued to be regarded as something of a miracle. Critically, for Venezuela's future, Gómez oversaw and encouraged the extraction and sale of petroleum, which was the real gold of Venezuela. Even more than cocoa or coffee had been, oil would become a single crop on which the economy would depend, bringing unimaginable wealth into the country, but bringing it only to some people and eliminating, as less profitable, other ways of making a living. Venezuela had always known it had oil. At least it knew it had something that was black and sticky and useful for patching leaky roofs. But in the early 1900s, with the invention of the automobile and airplane and other vehicles with combustion motors, gasoline was going to be in such heavy demand that crude oil was called black gold. At first, Venezuela, under Gómez's leadership, had foreign companies such as Royal Dutch Shell and Standard Oil of New Jersey, which would become Exxon, pay for the right to drill for oil and take it away, mostly from the shore of Lake Maracaibo. The Venezuelans didn't see any reason to process the oil in their own country. They didn't have refineries or people trained to run refineries. And they didn't, at that time, care what happened to the natural gas that is now a valuable byproduct of oil refining. The money they received was plenty, seemingly unlimited money for something they weren't using anyway. Venezuelans had their new single crop, and they didn't even have to grow this one. The government had money to pay for roads and the army, and to line the dictator's pockets. In 1929, Venezuela was the largest exporter of oil in the world, and would be until 1970, and oil money would keep the country rich during the World Depression of the 1930s. Oil urbanized the country as small farmers and landless laborers began to work in the company towns that grew up around the oil. The rich grew very rich indeed, and there also came to be an urban middle class. This was new. But while the country became rich, most of its people remained very poor. With a growing middle class and the coming of unions for workers, there was more resistance to Gomez, but his access to oil money and the national army it paid for kept them in check. By the time of Gomez's death in 1935, the country was, in some ways, modern. It had a centralized government with a strong army, strong enough that small caudillos and their followers could no longer threaten it. At Gomez's death, that army produced the new government by appointing as the country's leader General Eleazar López Contreras, the man who had been Gómez's Minister of War and the Navy. During the next two regimes, Venezuela began to modernize politically and economically. It increased the amount of money the country collected from foreign oil companies to 30% and instituted an income tax and social security. It also passed an agrarian reform law designed to distribute government land to small farmers who had none. But it was still a government created and supported by the military, and of a population of 3.5 million, 90% were illiterate. Roads were dirt, and there was no public health system. When the opposition party, the Acción Democrática, Democratic Action Party, decided that it was time for a democratic government, they organized and carried out a coup d'état. This somewhat dubious approach to establishing a democracy is something that Chavez supporters point to when his opponents claim that Chavez's 1992 attempted coup proves that he doesn't believe in democracy. Novelist Romulo Betancourt became president in October 1945 and tried to establish reforms. He wanted to give back land that Gomez had taken from people and to create small farms again. It was not until 1947 that a president was elected by the people of Venezuela, and that president, the novelist Romulo Gallegos, remained in power for less than a year before, in November 1948, the military took over the government again. Between 1948 and 1958, Venezuela was ruled by General Marcos Pérez Jiménez. When Pérez Jiménez attempted to get himself elected democratically in 1952, he ran into some problems. He wanted there to be a vote for a general assembly that would then choose a president. Him. The people didn't want to vote because they had no reason to trust the democratic process, so he made it mandatory to register and to vote. Then, when the elected assembly did vote for a candidate, and as the votes were being counted, someone else seemed to be winning, he simply declared himself the winner and told people to stop counting the ballots. They stopped. Pérez Jiménez's rule has been described as one of massive public works and heavy repression. There remained limitless oil money with which to build highways and public buildings, many of them too badly planned to be of use. Shopping centers and office buildings remained empty. A cloverleaf entrance to the highway was so complicated that it acquired a nickname, the Octopus. He did not provide money for better public education or public health. Pérez Jiménez was deposed on January 23, 1958, by a combination of a general strike in Caracas and a rebellion led by the Air Force. He flew to Miami, Florida. Hugo Chavez was 4 years old. In November of 1958, Romulo Betancourt of Acción Democrática was elected president by a popular vote, but people on all sides wished to force him from office. Pérez Jiménez's supporters got funding from the dictator of the Dominican Republic. Opponents on the left fought a continuous guerrilla war. One of them, Douglas Bravo, would later become a friend of Chavez's brother Adán, though ultimately an opponent of Hugo Chavez. Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, Armed Forces of the National Liberation, encouraged by the Cuban Revolution of 1959, hoped for a more left-wing government. Additionally, in 1962, left-wing parts of Venezuela's National Guard and the Marine Corps revolted, wanting Betancourt to nationalize the oil industry. Betancourt believed he could work with the United States, which was Venezuela's biggest customer, and which also owned most of the oil companies doing business in the country at the time. In 1954, the CIA had overthrown a leftist government in Guatemala, so Betancourt had reason to believe he was better off working with the United States and its interests than against it. Indeed, U.S. President John Kennedy would supply Betancourt with the missiles he used to defend himself during the Marine Corps mutiny in Puerto Cabrera. Chavez, born in 1954, was thus born into a world in which democracy had made few inroads, and into a part of the country and a class that had not benefited from Venezuela's great wealth. The democracy that did develop would succeed by some measures, and fail by others, which is what he came to address as he grew up and examined the political process and the economics of his country. The history of Venezuela's independence and of its dictators, and of the role of the military in the government, gives us a sense of the country's governments and their relation to the people. Other Latin American countries have similar histories, although Venezuela's oil has always set it apart. American or English critics of Chavez's democracy make a mistake when they compare what is happening there now only with some idealized form of democracy in the United States. After all, in 2000, the United States elected a president who received fewer popular votes than the loser. We can also see why Venezuela might have mixed feelings about the United States. During its days as a colony, Venezuela had been a source of income for Spain. What people living there wanted for themselves was, by the laws of Spain, less important than what Spain needed from them. It is easy for them to resent being seen only as a source of oil for other parts of the world. And it was always a country deeply divided by race and class. Captions to photographs and illustration. 1. General José A. Páez, 1790-1873, was General-in-Chief during the Venezuelan War of Independence from 1811 to 1812. Regarded as a hero for his part in liberating Venezuela, Páez went on to lead the country as president. 2. Dictator Marcos Pérez Jiménez was president of Venezuela from 1952 to 1958. Venezuela's economy developed rapidly during his term, but he was forced from office and lived in exile in the United States until he was extradited to Venezuela on embezzlement charges. 3. Venezuelan President Rómulo Betancourt, who served from 1945 to 1948 and again from 1959 to 1964, is shown at the United Nations General Assembly in 1963. End of captions. Chapter 4. Enter Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez was born on July 28, 1954, in the Llanos region of Venezuela, that low, flat region that historically has been the land of cattle, cowboys, and rebels. But his parents weren't ranchers or cowboys. They were elementary school teachers living outside the small town of Sabareta in the state of Barinas. His father dropped out of school after sixth grade, which was not unusual for a child of poor parents in rural Venezuela. What is less usual is that he later was able to go back to school and get the credentials he needed to teach. Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias, to call him by his whole name, was the second child born to Hugo de los Reyes Chavez and Elena Frias de Chavez. His older brother is named Adán, Adam, and Chavez says that if he himself had been a girl, his mother planned to name him Eva, so that they would be Adam and Eve. As it turned out, he was named for his father and his mother's grandfather. He also bears his mother's maiden name, Frias, as the last part of his own, as is common in Latin America. Both parents encouraged the children, Adán, Hugo, and four younger ones, to study hard, become educated, and then use that education as a means of getting out of Sabareta and out of poverty. It was an ambitious goal for them to have, since even on the salaries of two teachers, the family was poor. It would be, however, a goal they were able to achieve. Adán became a university professor before his younger brother became involved in politics, and Hugo's other siblings became an electrical engineer, a banker, an English teacher, and a businessman. Hugo Chavez's father, Hugo Sr., became governor of the state of Barinas in 1998. The intelligence and energy that enabled his father to go back to school and become a teacher clearly was passed along, genetically and by example, to the children. The family's house was, Chavez once said, made of palm leaves. At other times, he elaborates and says it was a house of wattle and daub walls, mud mixed with straw, called baareque, a dirt floor with a roof of palm leaves, like thatching. It was the most common kind of house in Venezuela, in a style hundreds or perhaps thousands of years old, and had no electricity or running water. Hugo, like his older brother, was born in the house of his father's mother, Rosa Inés, in the town of Sabarita proper. Her house was no better equipped than the parents' house, but at least in town there was a midwife to help at the birth. His mother's mother, Martha, lived in the town of Los Rastojos, which seemed a city to him, simply because its little power plant could generate the electricity for 2 hours of light in the evening. Both Adán and Hugo were raised by Grandmother Rosa Inés, whom Hugo called Mama Rosa. The house was in town, yet cattle grazed nearby, and mangoes, palms, avocados, papayas, and other trees grew all around. After the Chavez's third son, Narcisco, was born, the family moved into Sabarita, not 150 feet from Mama Rosa's house. There, the boy's father and mother built a small house of cement blocks with an asbestos roof and a cement floor. Hugo and Adán continued to live with their grandmother. If Chavez minded this or felt rejected by his parents, he does not say so. He speaks fondly of fishing with his father early in the morning at the nearest river. But he credits his grandmother with raising him, with teaching him to read, to work, to be honorable. He says he liked to work hard, although Adán, the one who grew up to be a college professor, preferred to read. By the age of 8, Hugo helped to sow and harvest the corn, to clean the yard, and to help make and sell the coconut buns and papaya cakes his grandmother baked. Hugo gathered the green papaya, then they peeled, seeded, and chopped them up, and Mama Rosa cooked them in sugar to make a sweet snack called spiders, which Hugo would sell at school. His grandmother would give him a small share of the money, which he kept in his plastic piggy bank. He would also go where people were playing bolo, which is a kind of bowling, or to cockfights, where people bet on the outcome of fights between trained roosters, usually fitted with metal blades on their feet, or to festivals for the patron saint of the village. All of these are the common entertainments and festivals of Venezuela and the rest of Latin America. Hugo also picked and sold oranges to the local ice cream maker, and Mama Rosa was generous about making sure the boys got lots of ice cream, which Hugo loved. It was a childhood of hard work and little money, so that the boys went to school in ratty clothing and homemade sandals, or in high school in old rubber boots. But Chavez doesn't speak of having been unhappy. He seems to have been secure in his grandmother's love, happy to be with her while she watered and talked to her plants, and he sang to them. He also liked Mexican movies and a popular kind of music from Mexico called rancheros and llaneros, the folk music of the people of the plains. With his mother, Hugo had a more difficult and rebellious relationship. Once, when she was going to hit him with a stick, he doesn't say for what or if this was a typical punishment of that time and place, he grabbed the stick away from her and then ran away to the mountains. He disagreed with his mother about other things than her hitting him, though. She wanted him to be a priest, and he obediently served for 1 year as an altar boy, cleaning the church's statues of Jesus and the saints, helping at Mass, and ringing the church bells. He did this last task so enthusiastically that everyone could tell when it was the little Chavez boy ringing the bells. He was a child of great energy and enthusiasms, and very strong likes and dislikes, and as much as he enjoyed bell ringing, he came to dislike other things about the church. He especially disliked the way his church depicted Jesus as a meek victim. He believed in another reading of the Bible, one that is shared by many other Christians, which emphasizes the Jesus who was a rebel, a revolutionary, Chavez says. Jesus overturned the power structure of his people, criticized the leaders, condemned corruption, and spoke often and passionately about taking care of the poor. That distinction, believing in Christianity while often being angry at the clergy, whom he has been known to call devil's investments, remains. As a child, Hugo heard something that disturbed him a lot. His grandmother, Martha, while scolding Hugo's mother, said she was willful. "Elena, you are like that because you are an offshoot of that murderer, your grandfather. Rafael's father, he was a murderer. He killed a man. He tied him to a tree and shot him, and he cut off another man's head right in front of his children." That would indeed be a disturbing, though perhaps also exciting, thing to hear as a child. But it wasn't something that anyone would talk to him about. It was only later, as a young man, that Hugo learned that his great-grandfather was Pedro Pérez Delgado, who, from 1914 until his capture in 1922, fought against the dictatorship of General Juan Vicente Gómez. Chavez would come to see his great-grandfather as a hero guerrilla fighter, rather than as a murderer, but that wasn't how he was brought up. His parents did not speak proudly of the guerrilla fighter in their family. Coming to understand another way of interpreting his great-grandfather's actions contributed a lot to who I am today, Chavez has said. He was also interested in a less controversial rebel, Simon Bolivar, who is almost considered a saint by many Latin American people. At age 12, Chavez was in many ways a typical boy of his time and place, although he was unusual in that he stayed in school even though it required him to move to the bigger town of Bolinas for high school. Like the majority of Venezuelans, he is of mixed racial origins, with a blonde, although mixed race, mother, and a father who is of both black and Indian descent. He was a thin boy, with feet so big that his classmates called him Triblin, the Spanish name for the Disney character Goofy. He was, however, unusually creative and strong-willed. Many children dislike it when the doctor gives them shots, but Chavez says it took his father and three men to hold him down for his vaccinations. "I was both a coward and a rebel," he has said. But does he say proudly or ruefully? It's hard to tell. He liked to paint and sculpt, and won prizes for his artwork, and also for a play he wrote, and used to get jobs singing at children's birthday parties. Like most Venezuelan boys, Hugo preferred baseball to all other sports, even though as a child he and his friends had to play with a rubber ball and use a wooden plank as a bat. Baseball, brought to Venezuela in the late 1890s by rich young men who were attending American boarding school, is Venezuela's national sport, as it is in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and Panama. In most Central and South American countries, people are passionate about soccer. It is a little thing, but it is important. The countries that love baseball are the countries that looked to the United States for their model during the late 1800s, rather than to Europe. It is one small part in the complex relationship that has existed between Venezuela and the United States historically. Chavez was more than just a baseball fan. One of his greatest heroes was Néstor Isaías Látigo Chávez, no relation, a Venezuelan who pitched for the Major League San Francisco Giants. Hugo Chavez was a good pitcher himself. One trait that is consistent in his character is that he works hard and usually does well at everything he attempts, and he dreamed of one day being a Major League pitcher in the United States like his hero. When Hugo was 14 years old, Látigo died in a plane crash, and Hugo was so upset that he missed 2 days of school. 5 years later, Hugo was still writing about Látigo in his diary, a long time for a teenager to remain loyal to a hero. Later, in 1974, as a young man in the military academy in Caracas, Chavez would note in his diary that Venezuela didn't have a strong enough sense of its own identity. Even his beloved baseball came from America, of whose policies he was already critical, yet that couldn't make him love baseball any less, then or now. Chavez would later say that for boys like him to have to leave home for high school makes it too hard for young people to continue with their schooling. Some of his government policies are based on the desire to make small farming towns easier to live in, make a living in, be educated in, and get good medical care in. But he graduated from the Daniel Florencio O'Leary School with a degree in science. In Venezuela, as in many countries in Europe, students begin to specialize in a subject while still in high school, choosing to focus on science or classics, or to begin work in some less academic field. Politically, Chavez was influenced by two of his best friends. They were the sons of a man named José Ruiz, who had been jailed for being a communist by the military dictator Marcos Pérez Jiménez. The first books Chavez read on communism and socialism may have come from the household of the Ruiz family. Captions to photographs. 1. Hugo Chavez was born in the state of Barinas, into a poor family that stressed the importance of education to succeed in life. 2. Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, was the city where Chavez attended military school. In 1958, an angry mob attempted to attack the municipal police headquarters. End of captions. Chapter 5. Toward a Revolution. When the 17-year-old Hugo decided to attend the Venezuelan Academy of Military Sciences in Caracas, it was not because he was interested in a career in the military. Rather, he had been advised that the academy was his best path toward a career in Major League Baseball. As it turned out, the military academy suited him. A bit self-conscious from having come from a tiny rural town, he seemed shy and well-mannered to his classmates, but also likable and articulate. Chavez was still a skinny guy with big feet. People who knew him then say he wasn't handsome and he had trouble getting girlfriends. When one girl rebuffed him and hurt his feelings, He took a rotting donkey's head that he had found by the side of the road and deposited it on her doorstep. It is the sort of story that appeals to people who are interested in Hugo Chavez's character. He seems, throughout his life, to be proud, impulsive, and at times quick-tempered. He majored in Army engineering, played baseball, and for a time had his own local radio station. He even emceed a beauty contest. His studies also included political science, history, and Marxism-Leninism, and he pursued his boyhood interest in Simón Bolívar. He and his friends began to speak of Bolivarianism and to dream of a united Latin America. And it would be a Latin America that helped the poor. Douglas Bravo, the guerrilla fighter who was a friend of Hugo's brother Adán, had also spoken of Bolivarianism. It is not an idea that began only with Chávez. People speak of Chávez's political awakening, a time when political issues really came alive for him. The writer Gabriel García Márquez, who has written novels about Simón Bolívar and dictator Juan Vicente Gómez, says that Chávez's political awakening came with the assassination of Chile's president Salvador Allende in September of 1973. The overthrow of an elected president by military officers shocked him into thinking about the modern political situation. At 19, Chávez says, he saw Carlos Andrés Pérez inaugurated as president, and he says he wrote in his diary, "Watching him pass, I imagined myself walking there with the weight of my country on my own shoulders." If that is true, it is the only evidence that Chávez was thinking so early about becoming involved in the political process. Richard Gott, author of the first book about Chávez in English, said Chávez was first politicized by his 1974 visit to Peru to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Peruvian independence from Spain, which came about after an 1824 battle in which Bolívar fought. In 1968, Peru had been seized by a left-wing military regime that began to try to reshape the country in ways that would influence Chávez later on. Peruvian President Juan Velasco Alvarado, president from 1968 to 1975, gave each of the visiting cadets and young officers a booklet of his speeches called The Peruvian National Revolution, which Chávez treasured. Chávez saw a strong bond between the Peruvian people and their military, and he admired it. By the time he graduated from the Military Academy in 1975 with a degree in Military Arts and Sciences, he had begun to think about the need for the military to have a role in running the country. And yet, with his father's interest in politics, his own boyhood enthusiasm for Bolívar, and his school friends with whom he read about communism, he must have thought about politics all along. It was inescapable. Still, as when he interpreted his great-grandfather Pérez Delgado as a freedom fighter rather than as a murderer, he would come to disagree with his family about politics for a time. He wouldn't talk with his family about politics when he was a cadet. His father had become a member of COPEI, the more conservative of the two main political parties. As a young man, Chávez began a book about his great-grandfather and started to travel from town to town looking for documents in libraries and archives and talking to people about the stories that were told about the guerrilla fighters of that time. He told Gabriel García Márquez that it was while traveling to do this research that he inadvertently crossed Venezuela's border into neighboring Colombia, where he was promptly arrested as a spy. The camera, photographs of the area, maps, and tape recorder that he carried could easily have been the tools of a spy, and how could he prove otherwise? He was interrogated for hours and nearly exhausted. Then, as he and his interrogator sat, deadlocked, under a portrait of Simón Bolívar, Chávez thought of what to say. "Look, my captain, the way life is, just a century ago we were a single army, and that fellow who is watching us from the painting was the commander of us both. How could I be a spy?" His interrogator began to speak of Bolívar's dream of a Gran Colombia, and the two men wound up drinking beer in a bar together. The next day, a hungover Chávez was sent home across the border with a big hug. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.